sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar. The auctioneer makes it clear and boom.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you very much.
And on this 10th anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, since you have been visiting and studying Afghanistan for many decades, since the 1970s, I'd like to get a sense, as we continue to spend $8 billion a month in this war-torn land of mud brick villages, I wanted to sort of get your perspective on the American decade in a country often described as the graveyard of empires.
Well, two things. What I would say is that the United States went in probably too optimistically about the degree of peace it established at the end of 2001 and the degree to which it could transform Afghanistan. At the same time, at the end of 10 years, I think both frustration and for the first time spending much attention looking at the problems of Afghanistan has actually made people, far more negative about it. The truth probably lies somewhere in between. We attempted to do too much. We lost many, many opportunities. But at the same time, we really haven't stepped back and said, okay, what do we really want? And more importantly, what do the Afghans really want that might lead to a stable future?
Well, but at this point, and I think a lot of people have suggested that this has been a subtext, if you will, if not, front and center for since it began, is the extent to which it's a surrogate war between India and Pakistan. Now that, of course, Afghan's leader was recently in India making a strategic alliance of some kind, the first such alliance that the country has in fact made. How much has this 10-year decade been a history of the United States going one direction and its supposed ally Pakistan undermining it at every step?
Well, I think that started from day one, when Pakistan said that it would handle its side of the border and make sure bin Laden and al-Qaeda did not escape from Afghanistan, that they would handle their half. When it turned out, they allowed that border to be porous so that bin Laden and many of his cohorts escaped from Tora Bora. But more importantly, they decided that they would side with us in trying to suppress al-Qaeda to a certain degree, but they never really dropped their support of the Taliban. On the other hand, I do not think, at least until recently, it's really been a surrogate conflict between India and Pakistan. I think that's Pakistan's mentality. I don't think until recently it's been on India's radar whatsoever.
But there are indications that India sees a strategic vacuum as the U.S. and NATO pull out in 2014.
As I was saying, until recently, sure, I didn't think that was true. But in fact, when it looked like Afghanistan was going to remain unstable, that Pakistan was continuing its disruptive policies, and that the United States and its Western allies were about to leave, I think that did focus India's attention, because they are the regional power in the area, and they are the ones that most directly feel the brunt of jihadist groups, both in Kashmir and attacking India itself. To see that as a situation that they would find strategically destabilizing. So I believe over the past few years that, it has moved much more in that direction. But I don't believe it originally started out that way.
Well, Thomas Barfield, just dealing with the present, where these remarks by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs obviously were pointed and very blunt. And my understanding is that that Admiral Mullen was feeling pressure from the junior officer corps in Afghanistan, who are fed up with, in effect, being shot in the back, you know, either by Pakistan or by the, you know, across that border where the, essentially it's a haven or a refuge, a sanctuary from which all these attacks are being launched, or most of these attacks are being launched. And after all, the Quetta Shura is in Quetta, which is in Afghanistan. So is it now, is there anything to be gained from this kind of honesty? Because it seems to me that deluding ourselves isn't particularly helpful.
I think it's a refreshing step in the right direction. This has been well known for most of the decade that this has occurred. And it's not just the junior officers that have complained about this. It's the senior officers as well. But for political reasons, particularly when the Bush administration named Pakistan a major non-NATO ally, allowing them to receive more advanced weapons, even though that they'd really not held up their side of the bargain. Until the Obama administration, and I'd say really almost until, you know, the past year, and particularly with the death of bin Laden, the whole contradiction in this policy had by both sides been buried. And because there wasn't so much American attention on Afghanistan or the Pakistan relationship, the question of how can you have an ally that's supporting your enemy, it's a contradiction in terms, that has now entered the American political debate, which it really hadn't before. So we're seeing something that was well known, but it's now moved to a policy a level. And also, until recently, Pakistan has been able to control the terms of debate, that maybe there's some problems, but they really are our allies. And I think these protestations, particularly when bin Laden was discovered, you know, near Pakistan's West Point, this had been ringing hollow in the region, and particularly Afghanistan, for a very long time. It now rings hollow in the United States as well.
Again, I'm speaking to Thomas Barfield, a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So, Thomas Barfield, I'm sort of hear contradictory things from people that are either specialists on Afghanistan and Pakistan and political activists as well. The political activists are suggesting that, and this is being reflected in the press in Pakistan, that the upping of the ante in terms of Admiral Mullen's rhetoric, etc., and the increased use of drones is an indication that the U.S. is likely to cross the border in hot pursuit and change the rules, you know, going back to the Vietnam War with the bombing Cambodia, that analogy. That's one scenario. I find that highly unlikely. I mean, the U.S. military must understand that's a hornet's nest across the border there, and it's, you know, there's nothing they can do about it, essentially, right?
I believe they're loath to get involved in attempting to move into Pakistan's northwest frontier province. It presents a problem as that Pakistan declares its sovereignty over a part of the country that it actually has no control over. This is also one of the contradictions that people really don't understand, is that even when Pakistan came into existence as a nature, the Fatah, the federally administered tribal area, always was outside of direct government control. The British had left it that way. So you had this ungoverned territory up against an international border. And that's always been problematic. That's been problematic ever since they drew the border. But that has been recognized. I think probably the greater pressure is on Pakistan to do something about the Quetta Shura. Baluchistan, where Quetta is located, is an area where Pakistan does control. And so I think if there's any sort of quid pro quo in terms of what the United States is looking for, it may have as much to do with the so-called Quetta Shura Mullah Omar and his people than it does with the so-called Haqqani network, the people that straddle the border in the tribal districts.
But Thomas Barfield, if my understanding is that the president doesn't want to escalate this war. He actually wants to get the hell out. They need the money that's being wasted there, billions and billions, as I mentioned. I believe it's $8 billion a month, $150 million a week or something. That seems to be pretty clear that they want out. I don't even know that the American Empire types in the military have much traction here. So where does it stand if we pull out? Obviously, Pakistan's going to try and fill the vacuum through their Taliban surrogates, and that seems to be what they've been doing all along, is just sort of keeping their powder dry or keeping their foot in the door, if you will. What about this talk of we need to keep Pakistan stable and keep our relationship going because of the possibility of loose nukes, et cetera? Where do all those scenarios stand in your mind?
Well, in my mind, we need to separate out the Afghanistan problem from the Pakistan problem, that Pakistan and the possibility that it could split or that the government could lose control to its own insurgents is a separate question from Afghanistan. And the question that comes up is that the Taliban took over essentially because there was a vacuum in the 1990s that no country was interested in Afghanistan. That made it very easy for neighbors to support surrogates at a very small scale and have a great impact. It's not clear that the United States, even with it withdraws its troops, is going to withdraw completely. It could still leave 25 or 30,000 troops on the ground. The Soviets withdrew every last person, closed every last base, and left. The United States seems to be talking about leaving about 20, 25,000 troops. If that is the case, I don't think the Taliban would have the ability to take over the government. They need an absolute withdrawal of international troops to be able to take over the government. And even then, I am not sure, since that would provoke a civil war, that they're in a position to win a second civil war in Afghanistan, since the non-Pashtuns who formerly formed the Northern Alliance would seek out international allies in order to prevent that. It would be very, very bad for Afghanistan, but it's no slam dunk that that Pakistan supported the Taliban would be as successful as it was in the 1990s.
And what about Pakistan's flirtation with China, the idea that it could replace the U.S. With China as its guarantor or financial guarantor?
I consider that to be, again, a Pakistani misreading of the international situation. Pakistan has provided nuclear technology to Pakistan, has provided missile technology. It's certainly built a number of infrastructure projects, but has never given Pakistan money. The United States has given billions of dollars to the Pakistanis, particularly the Pakistani military. It's dependent upon that. It is by no means clear that the Pakistanis can rely on the Chinese to replace any of that cash flow. The Chinese seem to have a remarkably tight purse when it comes to giving out money. Second, the Chinese just closed down a $19 billion agreement in, I believe, the Sindh project, a mining project, because they declared that Pakistan was too unstable. That doesn't sound like an all-weather ally. But I think the most important thing is that China, in its western part of its country, in Xinjiang, is concerned, perhaps overly concerned, perhaps even obsessive, about a Uyghur resistance movement. And the Uyghurs are an Islamic Turkish group in western China, some of whom were training in Pakistani camps with Al-Qaeda. I find it hard to believe that the Chinese would be keen on allowing the Pakistanis to support Islamist groups when they perceive a threat to their own western part of the country from these same Islamist groups.
But I've also heard, Thomas Barfield, the critique that while we are spending $8 billion a month on a country, war-torn country of mud brick villages, the Chinese are investing in new technology. And the irony is, of course, that the Chinese have a copper mine in Afghanistan, which the U.S. military protects, I believe. And there many people think that the American Empire is out for resources, and that's why we fight these wars. And it's not clear to my mind that the cost of Iraq is going to be yielded in Iraqi oil. And it's certainly not clear to my mind that the cost of Afghanistan is going to be yielded in American control of minerals and stuff. If you know, it doesn't seem like the U.S. is in there at all. The Chinese seem to be.
I certainly agree with you on that. Afghanistan has plenty of mineral wealth. The great irony is we seem to be stabilizing Afghanistan so that the Indians and Chinese can develop it. But I believe that's another reason why the Chinese are not too keen to see instability in Afghanistan, because that copper mine has just begun. It's not yet productive. And in order to make it productive, the Chinese would have to build a railway across Afghanistan to bring the minerals out. it needs a stable Afghanistan to make its investments pay off. So the Chinese have a strong interest in seeing a stable Afghanistan, just from a purely economic point of view. And so for that reason, I think that the mineral resources, the potential hydroelectric power that could flow from Central Asia to Pakistan. There have been riots in Pakistan recently about the lack of electricity. Pakistan's most obvious supply of that comes from ex-Soviet hydro plants. All of that requires a stable Afghanistan in order to allow the region to develop economically. So with the exception of Pakistan, I would say that every country in the region sees the desirability of coming to some kind of conclusion in Afghanistan that allows to become a normal country where investments can take place.
So if the U.S., China, India, Iran, and Russia, all the neighbors with a stake in a stable Afghanistan in the future, if they want stability, what can they do that's going to somehow convince Pakistan to accept whatever follows? Because what we continually hear is that this we could go back to a civil war, if not a surrogate war.
Yes, I think one of the things that India might do is simply say that if you do not want to see India directly involved in Afghanistan and taking the United States' place in Afghanistan, then cut a deal now. Because India, with far less troops, could decide it wants to take a training and support role of the Afghan government. And it has built a road from the Persian Gulf to the borders of Afghanistan. It could supply those troops without having to go into through Pakistan. India has no desire to put in troops or get involved in a war in Pakistan. But if it's a question of a political vacuum, a military vacuum, they could find themselves drawn in. Now, one way to use that positively is to say that is Pakistan's worst strategic nightmare. So why don't we negotiate a settlement so it doesn't come to that?
Well, Iran would have to agree with that, though, wouldn't it?
Yes, but Iran is a strong ally of India. It would love to see America out and India in. It helped facilitate India building that road across Iran.
So what about the dealing with Pakistan from the Indian perspective or from any of the regional players' perspective? The problem there is surely that there are two governments. There's a weak civilian government and a perennial military government.
That's why when we're talking about convincing the military, you believe if the international troops pull out that you have a Taliban victory, the Taliban are your surrogates. There's two problems with that. Number one, Afghans tend to be nobody's surrogates. The Taliban did not follow Pakistani advice in 2001 when they said, get rid of bin Laden, otherwise the Americans will come. The Taliban ignored that. Many Taliban are highly nationalistic. They may be working for Pakistan now, but if they were in power, it's not clear. They would feel themselves beholden. The second thing is that precisely because the Pakistani military is so paranoid about India, to say, well, this could happen, and particularly if the neighbors thought that would bring about stability, that might make more sense in terms of forcing a change in policy if the military thought, you know, this is essentially, you know, one of those checkmate kind of moves that we want to avoid. But I would say if every country in the region wants to see stability and Pakistan doesn't, it potentially moves itself into becoming a South Asian North Korea when its neighbors have to figure out how do we control a state that seems to be acting from the point of view of its neighbors irrationally and dangerously.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Kevin Zeis, who's one of the organizers of the ongoing demonstrations against the Afghanistan war in Washington, D.C.